Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me, we have two guest hosts. We have Shannon Camp and Zach Powers.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Do you want to tell everyone out there a little bit about yourselves?
Sure. We have a podcast together called Stage of Fools that's wrapping up its run, in which we sort of poked fun at the E! Television Network's modernization of Hamlet, mm-hmm. The Royals. So now is a great time to just...
The now late television
show, The Royals. Yeah, the dearly departed show, The Royals. So now is a great time to just tear through our back catalog if you want to hear two silly people tell you a silly story.
And we'll have... I don't know, one more that is coming out soon or just came out that's a final cap off to the entire show.
Yeah, so even we don't know what or when that will be. But also, I'm a writer and an actor, and you can check out my stuff at shannon-camp.com.
I have a second podcast called The Revisionists, which is a comedy history podcast.
That's your first podcast, really.
That's true. I've been doing it longer, so technically it is my first podcast. And the premise is we look at a person or event from history. One of us gives a real account of that person or event. Another person gives an entirely fabricated, crazy alternate version that could include whatever flourishes the writer determines it merits. And at the end, we vote on which becomes the true history of the world going forward. So, yeah, you can check that out. We just wrapped up our spooky Halloween run, where we covered most recently the Bloody Benders. So,
oh, yeah, the Bloody Benders. I know them from the Rick Geary comic. This is a special Election Day version of the podcast. I thought it might be fun to do something... Or fun in quotes, to do a play that dealt with issues that we're dealing with in this election cycle. So we are doing Henrik Ibsen's 1882 play, Enemy of the People. Is this a play that both of you have read or either of you have read?
I had not read it before. I think the only Ibsen I'd read before this was A Doll's House.
Yeah, I was also not familiar with this. I read A Doll's House in my junior year of high school just because I liked reading plays. I was at an age where I was really seeking them out. And I read Kate Chopin's The Awakening that same like semester. So I was really feeling it. It was lighting my young feminist fire. But then outside of that, besides doing maybe a few scenes from Ghosts in college where I was studying acting... That was pretty much it for me and Ibsen, although I do have to say his work always reminds me a lot of Anton Chekhov, who I do have a lot more familiarity with.
That's a good parallel. Ibsen was the sort of great granddaddy of realism in the theater, and Chekhov would be sort of the granddaddy of realism in theater. Although I don't know where, I guess Chekhov was a little bit later than Ibsen, maybe like a decade later.
Yeah, they're definitely different generations, but I agree with you, part of the same sort of movement. But I guess what always strikes me the most about both of their works, at least the translations that I've read, is it's usually a lot of characters outright stating their intentions and their feelings with no subterfuge. And then the subtlety is more in the themes of the story, right, and how the audience might interpret different storylines. But the characters' motives are very much laid out there by the characters. Like, often, they will walk up to their enemy and being like, I'm going to murder you tonight, so sleep with one eye open.
And they have, particularly in this play, there's a recurring theme of people having a certain theme that they're very into. I don't know if you noticed that Alexson, or whatever, however you want to pronounce that name, was very into moderation. He mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely. Now, Ibsen is best known for probably Hedda Gabler and A Doll's House, these great works of...
No, I was just saying, I always forget that he wrote Hedda Gabler because I've never actually read that in its entirety, but it's referenced and, like, riffed on in so many things. I feel as if I have.
Yeah. So he's known for his female characters. This play... not so much, I don't think.
No, yeah.
Especially at the ending when he's like, I'm all alone, as his wife and daughter are like, you can do it! You're the best father!
Yeah. Okay. So, but this is a play that has had something of a revival in recent years there because of its title, The Enemy of the People, and its themes, which are the themes of whistleblowing, of environmental problems and economic expediency. It's amazing to see that all these things were right there in the late 19th century, because in some ways this play seems very much of our current time. I saw a production of this when I was in college, but I saw a production in London of the Arthur Miller adaptation of this play. Arthur Miller took out a lot of the more problematic lines that our main character, Dr. Stockman, who is the titular enemy of the people, a whistleblower in his small, sleepy Norwegian town. Its sole economic basis is the baths that the town are going to need to thrive on tourist dollars. He's discovered that there is an infection of the waters, and he thinks he's going to be a savior to the town. He turns out not so much. But the Dr. Stockman, I don't think it's controversial to say a difficult character. He's on the one hand he's right, on the other hand he's kind of insufferable.
He's a prig with a G, folks. This is a clean podcast. I was going to say, I'm kind of not surprised that Arthur Miller took out some of the more problematic elements of Stockman's character, because we just watched the film version of The Crucible, which was directed by a stage director who just took the play and filmed it with absolutely no editing or changing things.
Yeah, it's...
And I was so struck by, like, the black and white political morality of that play.
It's one of those things where it's definitely that movie is like, sometimes you can tell when a person who directs plays directs movies, and that was a case. Or see again also the difference between Mamma Mia 1 and Mamma Mia 2, the latter of which was directed by somebody who does films.
Absolutely. No offense to Felidia something, whose name I love because it's Felidia. But I called it. We were watching it and I was like, I feel like this was done by a stage director. And Zach agreed. We looked up his credits. They were all from the National Theatre in London, which, you know, that's amazing. More power to him. But
speaking of stage plays, though, there was The Enemy of the People was just earlier this year performed at a theater here in Chicago called The Goodman, and we were off our season pass for one rotation and missed it. I regret it now.
The 1 year I didn't have a season pass since high school. The 1 year. But
I also read,
I really regret it.
Interesting tidbit that this play just 2 months ago was performed in China, and the Chinese government banned it after two or three showings because the people were relating too much to the Stockman character. And, I mean, you know, obviously opposition to the party is a contentious thing in China right now,
to say the least.
There was a article in the New York Times earlier this year about contemporary productions of this play. And it's amazing how malleable this play is to different concerns. There's one that sets it in Flint, Michigan, because it's obviously a story about water contamination and whistleblowing, and so it's very much appropriate for that. It had occurred to me as I was thinking about what could I do that might be a book for an Election Day podcast. It occurred to me that our president is very fond of bandying about this term, the enemy, the people, when he talks about the press, he's branded them the enemy of the people. And like many things with the current administration, I don't think he understands the irony of what he's doing. This play is about the way in which people demonize truth tellers.
Well, let me simplify that statement even a bit more. I don't think he understands the irony of anything. But also, it is kind of interesting. You know, I read that New York Times article. John sent it along to us to read. And it was really interesting, and I appreciated the perspectives. Like, there was a version here at a storefront theater in Chicago that was modernized that involved, like, one of the little boys dropping dead from drinking the poison water on stage. Mm. There was the Flint, Michigan version. There was even other versions that we were reading about. But a lot of the quotes in the article were from artistic directors and, you know, theater directors who were obviously very anti-Trump, anti-Trump administration and what's going on. But at the same time, the play is kind of about shady journalists in a way, you know? Like journalists who are willing to hide and twist the truth.
To existing power structures relatively easily.
Yeah, to be bought, to serve their own interests, to get the glory for themselves, but to have readership. So it was like, that was interesting to me. Not a necessarily a negative on the play. It's just interesting.
Removing it exclusively from the lens of Donald Trump, I think there's salience in that because there is a lot of criticism of journalists having to treat perhaps spurious or unserious claims as legitimate arguments that exists nowadays. And you could probably see some of that in, what was the name of the newspaper? The People's...
Oh, right. The People's
Messenger?
People's Messenger, yes.
Well, I was thinking of S. Lacken a lot when he was talking about moderation. I started thinking about that radio rule where they have to give equal airtime to both sides, even if one is like complete raving lunatic conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
So that was definitely on my mind frequently.
It's good to bring up this point that you make that this play is critical of the press. It's certainly critical of Dr. Stockman. It's critical of the press. I don't think anybody comes off that great in this play. Maybe Petra, Dr. Stockman's, she's kind of, at least she's got purity of motive.
She really seems like one of those, like, you know, long-suffering, pure side characters who is like there to guide the path of moral purity, like present the way, but does not have much going on the interior, really, when you break her down.
And hundreds of characters for young women exist like this. They're often the only character for a woman in the entire show.
In fact, it's interesting. I mentioned before we recorded that the last time I was on the show, we did Crime and Punishment, and in some ways, Dr. Stockman and his very grand image of himself does remind me of some of Raskolnikov's tendencies in that play. And Petra reminds me of, I forget her name, but the young prostitute he falls in love with in that play, who's a devout Christian.
Well, Petra is also like a literal foil for the corrupt mayor Peter Stockman, because her name is Petra Stockman. It's the female version of Peter. It's like, you couldn't make it any clearer, could you, Henrik? But the funny thing is, you know, I agree with Zach that there is a lot of validity to Ibsen's critiques of the press. I also do have to chuckle that what spurred him to write this play was the press critiquing his previous play. Much like Dr. Stockman, just because he has legitimate things to say doesn't also mean he has a bit of an ego.
That was the play Ghosts, which deals with syphilis, amongst other things. And the press saw it as immoral. Ibsen was convinced that what he was doing was a great service to everyone, you know, to write these plays. I mean, he is a good playwright, I'll give him that. But he also, if you take a look at him, he looks a little bit like Scrooge McDuck. It's a typical late 19th century play in that it's got very limited stage dressing. There's basically two locations. Well, three, I guess. There's three locations, but one of them is used for three of the acts. And there is, as you pointed out, Shannon, an awful lot of just declamatory talking. People come in and they say what's on their mind, and everyone seems to show up at Dr. Stockman's house to say what's on their mind.
You're a father, but I have to tell the truth. But you're a father. You can't do this, but I have to.
Well, I will say that initially, at the beginning of the play, though he does end up feeling quite insufferable, Dr. Stockman seems like a pretty cool guy at the beginning. He's just having people over for...
drinks!
Yeah,
tahis. His daughter comes in, she's like, oh, work sucks. He's like, I know, grab a cold one.
But it's his radical transformation is all the more stark in how quickly it happens that he becomes this full-born, like, full-throated revolutionary over the course of, I guess, a day or two.
He's regular Bronson Alcott.
Yeah. He gets complete personality transplant. Like, nothing of the original Dr. Stockman remains at the end of the play.
Now he's Mr. Stockman.
So Dr. Stockman has the bad fortune of determining that there is a bacterial infection in the waters caused by a tannery downstream. Early on, Dr. Stockman's father-in-law, the father of his long-suffering wife, shows up and purports not to believe in the story that there's bacteria in the waters. And I thought at first, oh, this is just him being disingenuous. But then I thought, wait a second, how long ago did they actually discover bacteria? And it wasn't that long. I think that I was looking up the history of germ theory, and Louis Pasteur discovered that fermentation was caused by microbes in 1854. And within 10 years' time, they had determined that there were such a thing as bacteria as well. And by the end of the 19th century, they had only identified something like 20 different bacteria.
Well, yeah, I was really struck by how this is probably a time period where there's still some equivalence between cleanliness and moral purity. Like, I think his name is Morton Keel. Yeah, Morton Keel, the tanner, his father-in-law, seems genuinely, like, hurt and offended that Dr. Stockman would insinuate that him and his father and his father's father would be doing this, making their living via, like, an unclean practice.
He does. And I mean, tying into that idea of cleanliness during Stockman's kind of breakdown at the town meeting, like,
which one?
part of his complaint about people is he has some bit about how often they clean their homes and scrub their floors and it leaves no room for oxygen in their brains. It reminded me a little bit of even of the Doll's House ideas that he tackled earlier of you know, or maybe later, I'm not sure, of presenting you know, a clean facade, but underneath perhaps it is a little less desirable.
Well,
but
he also compares them to animals.
He does, yeah. Vermin, specifically.
Curs, in our translation.
And curs, too. Yeah, both, I think.
That's the problematic part we were talking about earlier, which is in the late 19th century, after the scientific revolution of the Age of Enlightenment, and with the advent of all these new natural theories, including evolution, there was a lot of thought about the relative station of people, you know, because you see it in the other great realism in England was being carried out very differently by Charles Dickens in the 19th century, much more to a much more sentimental end. But he was very concerned about social reform. But even Dickens seems to subscribe to this idea that there are good people and bad people, and it has a lot to do with breeding. That's why someone like Oliver Twist gets to be a hero, because it turns out he's just a misplaced child.
Yeah, that's like Frances Hodgson Burnett, too, although she wasn't as much of a realist, but that's something that's always irked me about her stories. A lot of things from that era, like the era of the Victorian child, you have like rich kids dressing up in rags for their parents to pay a professional photographer to take a picture of them posed as an urchin. Speaking of which, sorry, real quickly, at the end of the play, he asks his sons, do you know any street urchin? They're like, yes, daddy, lots.
They did not go into that aspect of the problems in baths, that there is just street urchins roaming every corner of this town. They're too concerned about their precious hot springs.
If we're going to talk about endings of scenes, of acts, I was sort of startled by the ending of Act One. Because it doesn't end so much as it stops. We end with Dr. Stockman saying, I feel tremendously happy. It is a splendid thing for a man to be able to feel that he's done a service to his native town. And then it's just like, curtain. And,
oh. Yeah. After his friends have spent the second half of that act saying, why, you're a regular friend of the people.
The most Chekhov-esque scene to me was when Petra was talking to the journalist who, like, I thought kind of seemed like maybe he had a thing for her. And he, like, says something to her, and she goes, like, no, you have revealed your true self to me. You have corrupted this, and now I will never trust you again. Here, find someone else to take this book.
That was
pure Three Sisters.
No, I absolutely read that as he says that part of his mixed ideals and more compass about publishing the piece relates to Dr. Stockman, not because he's a good man.
It's because your father.
Because he's your father. And I think she, at that point, is like, well, I know you're just cozying up to me or lying to me because you, you're into me. I think I absolutely read it that way, yeah.
Yeah, it made me think of, like, yeah, it just made me think of, there's no other way to put it, a Chekhov play. There are a million scenes like that. Like, a man will come up to a woman being like, I'm in love with you. Let me have your hand in marriage. Be like, no, never speak of this again. And then like, okay, I'm going to go kill myself. He walks off stage. Gunshot is heard.
Typically, people are motivated by larger themes about the role of local government, the role of sciences, the role of journalism. But Ibsen tries to complicate motive sometimes. He tries to complicate motive between Dr. Stockman and his brother Peter in that at the beginning of the play, we're told that Peter is jealous of Dr. Stockman, that Dr. Stockman has a lot of goodwill out there, and he doesn't like the fact that Dr. Stockman is getting all the credit for the baths in the first place. And I feel like, yeah, I see what Ibsen's trying to do, but he kind of just half does it to me, as far as I'm concerned. I don't feel like, I never feel like he's really created a complicated character in Peter or in Dr. Stockman. Did you feel that way?
Something I was very confused by in that New York Times article you sent us was one of the directors mentioned, oh, in our production, we want to show that Mayor Stockman is actually part of the solution to the problem. It's not a bad thing. And I was like, without radically rewriting at least the last two acts of the play, how would you get that from this text? Because he is so determined to conceal this dangerous truth for the sake of profit.
In performance, you can upplay Peter's objections to Dr. Stockman's solution to the contamination of the water is radically shut everything down and then rebuild the whole system of drainage from the tannery and the water supply system to the baths, and that'll take 2 years and cost, I don't know what they ended up saying, it would cost
$20,000. I think they said $20,000.
Right, and whatever that is in it was pounds, and it was 19th century pounds, so I don't know what it was, but the that is a problem, you know, that this is a problem. It's sort of, it's what's interesting to me about this, of course, is this is the analogy for greenhouse emissions right now. We know what we need to do, but if we were to do it, it would have this enormous effect on the economy and an enormous effect on economies that can't withstand it as well as the West might be able to understand it, even though the West are the greatest contributors to greenhouse gases.
Is also Mayor Stockman also goes out of his way to totally conceal the possibility of this and demonize anyone who might try to bring it up and call them, you know, the enemy of the people. So that is also part of what I meant about him just being, like, by the end of the play, unambiguously bad. Sorry,
yeah. You were saying? I mean, obviously, part of the concealment factor is that if people in who are considering coming to visit the baths hear this story, even if they deny it heartily, a lot of them will probably be turned off from that particular trip. But I was going to say one thing that I expected to happen for the entire play that never did, and this relates to that version Shannon talked about where a child dies after drinking the water, is I expected a tourist or somebody to die and vindicate Dr. Stockman, and it never happens. Like, there is no real, like, tangible external vindication for this fear about the water. It just kind of is like, now he's a political revolutionary who's creating a school for radicals in the middle of town.
Street Urchin Fight Club.
I kept wondering, as I was reading the play through this time, how large this town is. It sure has a lot of the apparatus of a large city. It's got this active journalist contingent, you know, that is apparently a radicalized contingent. It is this newspaper seems to be coming at things from a far left perspective at the beginning of the play. What they want from Dr. Stockman is not necessarily the truth about the baths, but they want an easy a weapon to use against what they see as the entrenched interests of the town. But, you know, it's in Norway. It's the 19th century. How many people could be living in a baths town?
In the stage directions for our translation on Project Gutenberg for, like, the courthouse scene, the stage directions say, there's a large crowd of townspeople, a few women and schoolboys among them. So do with that information what you will.
And don't forget the, of course, large street urchin population that the town boasts. At least a dozen by the end of it. He says he can probably get 12 kids for this class. That's quite a population. It is unclear how large this town is, because it does seem like it should be, by rights, a relatively small tucked away vacation spot and not a thriving.
Maybe it's like one of those towns in Colorado where it's small, but everyone's crazy rich.
That seems possible. They do talk about
the
aristocracies that kind of early in the play, they talk about the aristocratic folks, the gentry who sort of run affairs about the town, although I don't feel that ever fully comes to fruition. It sort of does with Morton a little bit when, I mean, Dr. Stockman doesn't realize that Morton is rich until late in the play, but eventually.
Well, the guy's always covered in animal blood and shit because he's a tanner.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, he's also absolutely Machiavellian. At the end of the play,
that's true.
He goes around and he buys up all the devalued shares in the baths. And he's doing this to get hooks into Dr. Stockman to say, this is your family's inheritance. You better retract what you've said, because otherwise your wife and kids get nothing. But it has also the effect of everyone on the street sees Morton Kills out there buying up the stuff, and they think, oh, Stockman made up this story to devalue the shares, and now he's making out like a bandit. So it's a very effective act.
I also feel like that particular plot point has a lot more weight in the time period that the story originally takes place and was written, because, yes, in modern times, an inheritance can hugely help, you know, women and children if something were to happen to the head of the family. But this is during a time when women and children had very little ways of, you know, providing for themselves, owning property, having rights, stuff like that. So I did understand his concern over that a little bit more than if it were a modern day story where I'm like, is he just being a little bit greedy? Because this really was a time when they might seriously need that money.
The other thing I like is that Morton Kills shows up at the house carrying a bunch of shares with him. Because when I was a kid, you know, it seemed, didn't seem like there were all these cartoons about people with deeds of property, and whoever held that in their hands, they were the person who owned it at that point. At the end of Wind of the Willows in the Disney version, that's the whole point, is that everyone's trying to grab the deed because whoever holds that now owns Toad Hall. And
it's like a bearer deed. Yeah. It's just simply the fact of holding it bestows upon you ownership of the property. Yeah.
Stockman being thwarted in his original attempt to publish his findings in the newspaper calls a meeting to give a lecture about it. And his brother shows up and appoints the publisher of the paper the chairman of this lecture. You know, suddenly it becomes, instead of just becoming I'm giving a public lecture, everyone come hear what I have to say, there's going to be parliamentary procedure that's going to be followed. And it reminds me of whenever you see someone who's really good at politics who can just kind of twist what the subject is about. This is a stretch, but it reminded me most recently of the whole feud between Elizabeth Warren and Trump over the whole question of her heredity. You know, she had just said at one point that she had Native American ancestry, and then Trump said, you know, prove it, she did. And then suddenly it becomes, no, that's not the way you prove that you're a member of a Native tribe. And she got completely snookered there. She thought the argument was one thing, and it became something else.
Can't say I disagree with you.
Yeah, I mean, and they do that effectively in the town hall sequence, because eventually, and obviously as Lacson is sort of the moderator of that debate, I guess you would say. And it's bizarre because it does become a debate between Dr. Stockman and Peter in some ways, though eventually it is just Dr. Stockman ranting and raving. But early on, Peter sets the stage in a way that it's like, we are not going to discuss the scientific findings of any kind. And Dr. Stockman kind of holds to that. He just goes on this like weird rant about the state of democracy today and about how the certain majority is, in fact, strangling the philosopher kings among us.
I was obsessed with how they were like, everyone vote except this one tipsy man. One guy is drunk and they keep calling him out.
He comes back a couple of times. And the weird thing about that is there's, I feel like, a weird theme about drinking in this, but I'm not sure what it means. They have hot toddies at the beginning, and his brother is shown explicitly to not drink, like he refuses any alcohol.
So does Aslakin.
Yeah, he's a member of a temperance society. The drunk man comes back a couple of times. It does seem like there's this recurring theme of alcohol, and I'm not sure what I'm supposed to take from it.
They even accuse him of being a drunk and that influencing his scientific findings.
And the drunk is the only person who does not vote to make Dr. Stockman an enemy of the people, which, by the way, what a crazy thing to vote on.
That's a regular Animal Farm.
I got the feeling as I was reading that this was Ibsen trying to defend a certain amount of genteel hedonism. You know, the 19th century was full of things like temperance movements. It was also a heyday of people like George Bernard Shaw became vegetarian and very militantly so. There was a way in which new scientific studies were used to promote a certain kind of strict morality. These people were straight edge, basically. You know, they're going to present themselves as pure by virtue of the fact that they don't indulge in these sorts of things.
Yeah, it makes me think of Levin from Anna Karenina.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, I'm going to live on the land and marry a peasant and just be pure. And then he sees a pretty girl and is like, wait, no.
I think we're supposed to side with Stockman's. In some ways, he represents a kind of noblesse oblige, not the noblesse oblige of nobility, but the noblesse oblige of the educated middle class. As he's yelling at the people about how the majority is always wrong and that people are curs, he has this thing where he says that the people are the grist out of which the finer people are made. People exist, but they have to be educated. They have to be made better. And so there is a kind of a way in which he's there to privilege the intelligentsia, to privilege the successful middle class people with money. Now, of course, the trouble with all this is he comes off as something of a monster by the end of this act, if you follow the original Ibsen speeches and not the adapted versions of this play. Although I honestly am not quite sure how Ibsen meant his original audience to see this. Maybe I'm seeing this through my vision.
Yeah, because I think it was in that New York Times article they mentioned that quite a lot of other kind of respected thinkers from that era also had kind of weird ideas about how some people are just better than other people, whether because of education or breeding.
Yeah, sort of a proto-Nietzschean kind of idea of like superiority. But I agree that he comes off looking very badly at the end of that third act,
because oh, absolutely.
For a minute I thought that Ibsen was changing who the protagonist of the piece was. Like, that's how badly I thought he came off. And then I got into Act 4 and it was clear that Stockman was still the protagonist of the piece. But for a second I thought we were supposed to think that he was absolutely crazy.
Isn't he also the character who rants about, like, I've just spent as much as an average merchant would spend, da da da, like bringing other middle class trades into it?
Yeah, early in the book, there's something about how he and his wife spend just about everything they make. Like,
oh,
they
yeah.
do not save
yeah,
anything.
Yeah, that was so weird. And then it was just completely passed over. I guess that's why they need those stocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was there to lampshade the problem that at the end of the play, with the town turned on the Stockmans and the angry mob vandalizing his house and everyone refusing to patronize him anymore, they're now in financial ruin rather than, oh, well, I guess we'll just live off of, you know, what we've squirreled away for the last 20 odd years.
Just thought they were going to live off that tannery money forever.
I mean, assuming this town is small, I wonder how many actual doctors they have. I would think he provides a relatively important
yeah.
service to that town.
They threaten they're going to, like, disbar him. I'm like, well, then you guys are going to be in trouble if anyone gets a pneumonia.
Well, this does have that play compression of time, and everyone right. does seem to change radically very quickly. It could be that, you know, if there were another act after this, the townspeople would just turn back just as quickly as they turned.
Yeah. Like I said, if there was another act, what I would expect to happen is, again, what I was assuming was going to happen from the beginning of the play, something happens where a tourist dies and Stockman is vindicated in the eyes of the people. Like, and they come to regret their, you know, their short-sightedness or their materialistic nature, but it straight up doesn't happen.
Looking back on Stockman, my estimation of the character is just so colored by that final scene where he's screaming about how a strong man stands alone while his family is like, yes, you're alone! We're with you while you're alone!
It is brought up a time and again by various people and by his wife that it's not just Stockman on the line here. He's bringing his family along for the ride, for good or for bad. Petra is behind him 100%. His wife comes around after, after someone accuses him of, after someone sort of threatens him with, oh, you should do this for your family. The wife says, doesn't he get to have an opinion even though he's got a family? But it does hold Stockman up as this grand man, you know, this lone genius from one way or another. Ibsen liked characters like this. The only other Ibsen play I've read is one that a lot of people don't know, called The Master Builder, which is kind of, you know, it's about an architect. So in some ways, it's like Ibsen's version of The Fountainhead or something like that.
It is worth, yeah, I mean, obviously, Morten Kiel, or Kill, sort of very clearly at the end levies this financial threat against the family. I don't think, one thing we haven't mentioned is that Morten is his wife's father. He's Dr. Stockman's father-in-law. So he is literally willing to impoverish his own daughter and grandchildren if Dr. Stockman goes forward with these, presenting these findings publicly, which is pretty, I've got to say, I mean, they present Peter as the sort of the villain of the piece, but that is the coldest thing in this play.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, Peter is not a great brother either. I don't think that, I don't think anyone comes off as being particularly great when it comes to family. Either they are willing to sacrifice family members, as in the villains of the piece, or even our ostensible hero, Dr. Stockman, just doesn't seem particularly concerned about his family.
It's more about this idea of service to the community, but service to his own family is a deep second to providing that sort of community betterment that he's striving for.
Yeah, and of course, completely cast off to the side, when the play starts, Petra is like, oh, teaching, I have so many ideas, I'd love to open my own school. And then by the end of the play, she's lost her job over her father's reputation.
But he is opening a school to turn people into open-minded folks.
Oh, no.
And I think he does ask for her help.
Yeah, but I feel like that's not what she had in mind.
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, in some ways, it's an interesting ending, because 19th century novels and plays were notorious for ending with people in ruin and quite often in suicide. And one of the reasons I have never actually read Hedda Gabler is because that's another play that ends in suicide. And I got tired some point in my undergrad years when I realized that there were so many 19th century novels about strong women who were crushed by the world. You know, you had Sister Carey, you had Madame Bovary, you had Anna Karenina, and I just got tired of that as an idea. So I kind of like have never gotten around to reading Hedda Gabler. I probably should one of these days.
That goes all the way back to Antigone.
Yes, I mean that was your out if you were a woman. You know, if you got to die, I guess, on stage or off. But Stockman gets to end this play on a quasi heroic note. I don't know what we're expected to believe him doing from here, but he has a place for his family to go live. You know, that old crusty old sea captain is going to take them all in, and
that character is quite interesting too. This character who at the beginning of the play is very open about the fact that he does not vote, does not follow politics, does not care, and at the end of the play is putting up the only person who's still on the Stockman side outside of the immediate family.
I was very struck by that line about how like, people on the ship never seem to care that much about what's going on the shore. That really, like, resonated with me. If we're taking this play into our modern political era, the idea of, like, people being willingly oblivious to things that are not of immediate concern to their lives, even if in a larger sense they should definitely be worried about it. There were definitely moments that, some of which I believe were intentional, that made me laugh. Like, there's one scene where they're in the newspaper office and Peter Stockman is hiding from his brother when his brother comes in, and Aslakens comes in and is like, oh, this is awkward. Well, I just print the papers, you know, so I'm going to go back in the printing room and do that. And, like, I'm not paraphrasing. That's how our translation read. And then he backs out of the room. So some, I feel, were less intentional, like the boys being like, we know street urchin's father. But some felt like he was purposely adding a little bit of fun, tongue-in-cheek humor to the story.
That sequence with the brother who had gone to the newspaper to cancel the publication of the piece, hiding from Dr. Stockman, did feel very comedic. Even
it was
like
noises off.
It was, yeah. Like, and then Dr. Stockman's there, and Peter's hiding in the closet,
there's
but
like
he forgot
hat.
His hat and cane. And then he puts on the hat and cane and is like, I'm the mayor now.
Yeah. The people will see me in this hat and they'll say, he's the mayor.
Yeah, that was a very bizarre bit of little, like, comedic, almost, you know, slapstick, borderline slapstick stuff in the middle of this vaudeville kind of stuff, in the middle of this otherwise pretty dry play.
And he had like a silly moment and everyone acted like they were in the Beauty and the Beast, like, crazy old Maurice, send him to the insane asylum.
What did you think? What was your reaction as critics and also as actors? What would you think about performing in this play, or is it a play you would look forward to seeing a stage production of, or one that you kind of feel like, no, you got the idea?
I think I would really like it if I saw a well-done stage production of it with some judicious cuts and some maybe strong choices by actors and directors working together to kind of maybe make some different kind of choices for the characters. So I'm mad that I missed it at both the Goodman and Red Orchid, because those are both exemplary Chicago theaters, one of which is the biggest theater in the city and the other of which is a scrappy storefront theater that everyone's rooting for. And also, I always get cast as, like, the you can do it girl. Yeah. So
there's not a lot as far as
could conceivably be Petra or yeah. use some of this for an audition, which
you got.
I may someday.
Petra or Miss Stockman are about your only options, or a woman at the meeting among the schoolboys.
And half of Miss Stockman's lines are just coughs, like significant coughs.
Yeah. I am curious. Because obviously we read the original Ibsen version. I'm curious what Arthur Miller did to the play. I'm curious how his version is different. And I am low-key willing to bet that both the version that was at the Goodman and the Red Orchard were probably the Arthur Miller version and not the original take?
No, the Red Orchid version was a completely new modernization that took the story but used modern text.
Right, okay.
And the Goodman, I think, did their own edit of Ibsen's script, is my understanding.
I see, okay, yeah. Because I think, obviously, there are parts of this play that, I mean, really, Stockman and Ibsen, through him, come off as real crazy cranks
oh, yeah.
at points. And I think there's the bones of a good story here, and I think there's a reason it's resonating in the current political climate, but I do think that there needs to be some edits or some changes to make this material palatable to a modern audience.
Yeah, and I think that tweaking the female roles would definitely be a huge part of that too.
Yeah.
The production that set it in Flint, Michigan, I believe that both the Stockman characters, Dr. Stockman and Peter, were played by women. They were sisters in that production. So,
I feel like a lot of these characters could be gender swapped relatively
easily.
That's good and that's bad. It does show that these characters aren't necessarily that compelling for their personalities. They're compelling for the themes that they present.
I agree.
That's
so
true of other Arthur Miller plays, though.
And as I mentioned at the beginning, like, there are certain characters like Aslaskin, who half of his dialogue is about how he loves the he loves moderation, and moderation is the key to a good life. Every other line of his is about moderation. He's clearly just an avatar for that idea. And the other journalist, too, often talks about his liberal bona fides, like, constantly he's bringing these up. And it seems like these characters are not people, they're just representatives of ideas in a lot of cases.
That's why we have actors.
Thanks to co-hosts Shannon Camp and Zach Powers. Their podcast is Stage of Fools. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com for more funny, smart podcasts. you can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join in on Facebook or the Slack. Get out and vote, everyone, and keep up your reading, because everything will be on the final.